Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 149. It's Monday, January 31st. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, Omicron appears to have peaked in the United States, even as deaths continue to climb steadily. And in completely unrelated news, a man was found dead after successfully climbing Mount Everest. Apparently, he experienced the peak as over and was found frozen dead after only a partial descent. Well, folks, that somewhat comedic and deadly metaphor is my way of trying to express how I feel about where we're at in this pandemic now. The key is that when you're at the peak, you actually probably have more than half of your cases yet to come from that particular surge. And there's reason to believe that the tail of this epidemic, this particular surge, is going to be longer than average. The height and the drop, it's more of a narrow kind of mountain. But the second half of it is probably going to be long. And we're seeing at some other countries where it's kind of stalling out, you know, halfway down or two-thirds down, or even maybe a little bit more, but then starting to level off. And I've been looking at, haven't looked at a while for the social mobility, like cell phone data, where they look at movements of people and where they're going to, like, you know, stores or retail or transportation or work or staying at home, that type of thing. And definitely after the holidays, we saw an effect, a solid effect of people who are obviously scared of the Omicron and were appropriately, I'll say, concerned about Omicron and, you know, cut down on, you know, decrease mobility and stuff. So, you know, it's our basic form of social distancing. That was definitely substantial, although it was definitely less than what we saw last winter, which is probably appropriate. But the thing is, when we see a peak, we see that quickly that mobility rises, even though we're in the last half, where a half or more of the cases might happen. People start loosening up, and this, of course, is why often you see a longer tail. But the other reason, kind of biologically, of why we might see a longer tail is the son of Omicron, or what I've referred to before and has been called stealth Omicron. The Omicron variant is the BA.1 variant, but the BA.2 variant is the son of Omicron. It has about 85 mutations from the previous versions of the virus, which the father had 60 mutations, and this surprised scientists that it could evolve so quickly. This huge kind of quantum leap is raising the suspicion that this version of the virus moved from humans to an animal species and back to humans again, which could explain many changes, but of course this is just guesswork now, and I'll get to a story later about mutations actually happening in immunocompromised people, which we've talked about before. But the important thing with this BA2 variant, the son of Omicron, is it looks like it's more than twice as infectious. And a particular twist of it is it doesn't break through vaccination any better than the regular Omicron, but it does have increased infectiousness among unvaccinated. So if the unvaccinated somehow managed to avoid getting infected this far, this new version, the son of Omicron, is going to be even more difficult to avoid. And this might be more important Obviously, in different regions of the country, they have a lot more unvaccinated. But when you look worldwide, there are plenty of places in the world where the breakthrough of vaccination isn't the most important thing, because the majority of your population, maybe even overwhelming majority of your population, is not vaccinated, then this new Omicron is even more transmissible in those populations. The good news is it doesn't look like it causes any more severe disease per case. But of course, this increased infectiousness could be responsible for the stalling declines that we're seeing in different places. Okay, well, another thing to consider as we hopefully move to some more endemic state as we move through this ongoing pandemic is that we have to remember that even though Omicron is dominant, there are multiple variants that are circulating worldwide. These haven't disappeared. And of course, these variants appear in different places and sustain themselves because they thrive under different circumstances. So these older or previous variants may very well return or move around as circumstances change and population immunity changes or wanes. And an important thing to remember about COVID-19, when we try to compare it to the flu is very seasonal. COVID-19 does have seasonal effects. In other words, in the northern climes, you're going to see more COVID in the wintertime, for instance. But COVID has definitely busted out in non-winter times in the north, so it's not as bound to seasonality as flu is. And if we're kind of looking at it as an end game of something moving towards endemic, it looks at this point that I'm hoping that it's only several times worse than flu, because COVID is definitely much more infectious and it's more severe per case. So one thing that is changing and will be very different by the time we get to next flu season later this year is the antivirals. They're not cheap, but they work really well. But it raises the question from a public health point of view. Once again, like having vaccinations, you know, is great, but if you can't get into the arms of people, it's not going to do any good. And we've had, you know, a large swath of the population resistant to actually getting vaccinated. Well, it seems that the same people who are probably a slightly more, if not a lot more likely to get infected, are probably least likely to seek out early treatment with antivirals. So this is a little public health lesson. So primary prevention is when you would prevent the infection at all, so you have no infection. Secondary prevention would be if you have an infection or a disease or disorder state that you actually try to mitigate the damage, which an antiviral would fall in that category. Tertiary prevention, just for this particular lesson, is when you're talking about mitigating long-term effects, like say long COVID, if you're trying to prevent the additional damage of long COVID, that would be tertiary prevention, which actually is what we often would call, you know, some secondary prevention, and most of tertiary prevention is actually what we would call generally as healthcare. But in public health, we talk about primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. So the thing from a public health perspective, say as far as the antivirals, is you need to take them certainly within the first 5 days of having a symptom. But if you're, and it's the same way with flu, there's like Tamiflu, which is an antiviral, which if taken early, although it has to be earlier than 5 days, but if you have to take it early in order for it to work, if you take it 2 or 3 days into the flu, it's probably not going to do anything. But so Tamiflu, that antiviral for influenza, actually in practice, in the real world, does not prevent a lot of flu because people don't access it in a timely manner. And this is going to be the real test on the ground with these antivirals. In the laboratory, in clinical trials and stuff, they work really well. But a clinical trial is very different from the real world. So I'm hopeful that we can develop as part of our culture when people get COVID that they can do these antivirals, particularly people at higher risk, to mitigate the worst effects of COVID as we continue with this pandemic. Okay, well, as I mentioned just a minute ago, and I've mentioned in earlier shows, animal reservoirs and humans, particularly immunocompromised folks who can have long-term COVID infections, can be really petri dishes for multiple mutations. And here's a story from Bloomberg. COVID-infected HIV patient developed mutations, study shows. and the study adds to evidence that prolonged cases may cause variants. A South African woman suffering from inadequately treated HIV and who harbored COVID-19 for 9 months saw the respiratory virus develop at least 21 mutations while in her body, according to a study. So the trick is, you can actually literally have a single individual who could harbor and be a petri dish for multiple mutations. And then if that person infects another person and another person, that's the same way. As that's how worldwide pandemics happen. So if you, it starts with one person, goes 2, 4, 8, 16, you know the drill. So this is a long-term challenge in being able to prevent the additional variants that could be very deadly. For the son of Omicron variant, it was really stunning. If you look at the family tree, you look at all these other variants that just, you know, they get one additional mutation, they get two, then they get another, then they get another, then they get another, and you're tracking this. But this son of Omicron, it leaped out of the family tree and, you know, just gets a couple dozen extra mutations all of a sudden. And they're thinking it might be one of these particular cases in a human or potentially from an animal reservoir. It looks like some animals can be infected for a long time and may or may not get severe disease, just carried around, and the virus can mutate in one place for a long time. Okay, well, next up from the LA Times, this is kind of another little public health case study. LA County seeing more fatalities from Omicron as COVID-19 deaths climb. It appears that people who are dying from the Omicron variant are deteriorating much more quickly than those infected by earlier variants. It means that for the people who are, in fact, ending up passing away from COVID if they were infected with Omicron, it looks like they get hit pretty hard earlier on. During the summer Delta wave, COVID-19 patients were diagnosed with a coronavirus infection or started having symptoms 4 to 5 weeks before their deaths. But among fatalities reported in the earlier week, many had an initial onset of symptoms or first diagnosis 3 weeks or earlier before their deaths. That's a relatively short period of time between the time somebody gets infected, gets their symptoms, and then passes away. Also, an estimated 70% of coronavirus positive patients are there because of COVID. And for everybody who has COVID, it is a complicating factor. That's referencing that what they've been terming, I think inappropriately, incidental COVID. We shouldn't really, there's no really such thing as incidental COVID. It may be asymptomatic, it may be mild, but not incidental. So, okay, this raises a question because you might read this at first glance and jump to a conclusion that Omicron is more dangerous than, say, Delta because it kills people faster. But this is a good example to look at kind of the type and the quality of a study. This is what we would call a retrospective study. So you're looking at the people who happened to pass away, die from COVID, and you look back. And this is also very early because Omicron's come on fast. Less time has passed. So actually, there isn't as many people who've been around 4, 5, 6 weeks with Omicron in order to die. So those people are not showing up yet. They'll happen, but they haven't showed up yet. So there's biases built in these retrospective studies. They can be very helpful, but they're not as good as a prospective study. Most studies that have been looking at mortality try to look as best they can from the point of infection, following through the natural history of it and see how it results as far as severity and hospitalization and death, and then look on a per case basis how severe it is. That's a little bit better of a study. So just want to kind of clear that up. Don't want to scare people with that being more severe. I mean, I think it's true that Omicron is less severe than Delta, but it may have a little bit different profile. Now, the thing is, when you're looking at, you know, tens of thousands of cases and thousands of hospitalizations and hundreds of deaths, you know, you're looking at an entire population, and the severity might not follow what you would call a normal distribution, this kind of nice little up and down kind of curve where most people in the middle have a very similar experience. You might have very different experience in the tails. And I think what they're seeing in LA County and with this Omicron that's so much more contagious is that it may be actually kind of picking off, so to speak, the sick in the herd. People who were previously pretty successfully surrounded by unvaccinated folks, So previously in the pandemic, with less infectious variants, ones that were stopped when they hit vaccinated people, there was very, very, very many fewer breakthrough infections, so-called breakthrough infections with earlier variants. So, you know, by having vulnerable people surrounded by vaccinated people, which many, many people have done successfully around the country, that kind of falls apart when you get something like Omicron that can basically tag somebody in the outer circle and then they turn around and tag the person who's really vulnerable. Yeah, not good. So I think some of this effect may be that the floodwaters are rising and you've got this acrobatic Omicron, which can just jump over or bounce through the normal circle of protection that some of the most vulnerable people in the country have successfully avoided up to this point. And I think this may also relate to the so-called incidental cases, is I think a lot of times people say somebody with kidney disease or heart disease, they may get a relatively mild course of COVID, but it has an impact on an underlying chronic disease or diseases that they have. And they end up being hospitalized because they have kidney failure or a heart attack or something like that. So they go to the hospital or are admitted for kidney failure or a heart attack and then find out when they get there that they're actually infected. So they would not have been in the hospital had they not got COVID, which had pushed them over the edge. So these are not incidental because these hospitalizations would not happen necessarily without COVID, but they're showing up with the illness presenting as something else. And that's why people have this, first look view of saying it's incidental. But the underlying pathology is probably very much related to COVID. And also what I just mentioned is that people that have been particularly vulnerable have not been able to avoid this more highly contagious Omicron. And of course, if it comes down to future variants are even more contagious, the same problem. Okay, well, let's move on to testing. This from The Hill. Poll shows 62% who tried to find at-home COVID-19 tests had difficulty. A new poll finds that more than 60% of U.S. adults who tried to get an at-home COVID-19 test reported difficulty doing so, underscoring problems with testing access. The survey from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 62% of U.S. adults who tried to get an at-home coronavirus test in the past month had difficulty, compared to 38% who found it easy. The results were better for in-person tests, with 65% saying it was easy and 35% difficult. But experts have pointed to the value of at-home tests for their ease of use and rapid results, avoiding the need to wait days for a reading. The poll, which was conducted January 10th through the 23rd, adds some statistical rigor to the anecdotal reports across the country of retailers sold out of at-home tests. Overall, 23% of adults said they tried to get either an in-person or at-home test in the past month and had difficulty, the poll finds. It's almost a quarter of Americans had a problem in the last month getting a test, with 24% trying and not having difficulty, but a majority, 52%, who sought a test ended up not trying at all. That's kind of learned helplessness there. People realize that the system is so broke, they don't even bother trying. Well, I guess they're learning from other people's experience. When you hear all the horror stories of being not be able to get one, people just say, I'm not even going to bother. Of course, next up from Roll Call, a little bit of naive optimism from the Biden administration. Pharmacies governors say Biden test program is depleting supply. I don't find this surprising at all. The Biden administration's program to make 1 billion COVID-19 rapid tests available to Americans across the country appears to be exacerbating pharmacy supply shortages and making it more difficult for Americans to find tests on short notice after virus exposure, says some pharmacists and state officials. It's just a matter of numbers. I mean, there's just no question that when you take a billion tests out of the supply chain, it's going to have an impact, said Kurt Proctor, Senior Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the National Community Pharmacists Association. The Community Pharmacy Association surveyed 8,000 small pharmacy owners from January 11th through 17th and found 93% of pharmacists said they are having a difficult time sourcing enough at-home COVID-19 tests to meet demand. Some states also are complaining about delays in test orders. For example, Maryland ordered millions of COVID-19 rapid tests, but the orders were canceled by vendors due to their obligations to the Biden administration, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said during his weekly news conference on January 19th. Hogan said the White House told him that eventually state officials would receive their full order of roughly 4.8 million rapid tests as supplies expected to ramp up in February and March, but Hogan said Maryland needed these tests, quote, yesterday, which I think is accurate and fair. Last week, a bipartisan group of governors complained to the White House in a meeting that Biden's program was diverting their testing supply. Basically, the new programs did not produce any new tests. They just took all the tests off the shelves, Hogan said. It feels like we're almost back to where we were, you know, in the first year of the pandemic, when we were all searching for masks or searching for PPE. Now we're searching for tests, said Michael Bagel, public policy director at the Alliance of Community Health Plans. So I think the Biden administration's bungling of this testing going into this winter, big mistake, have to give them a fail on that. Perhaps, unfortunately, may be an indicator of what do we do, quote, post-pandemic in preparation for future pandemics, let alone the additional iterations of this pandemic. So we have this from Politico. Government watchdog says Health and Human Services at high risk of bungling public health crises. The Health and Human Services Department has failed to fix long-standing problems in its pandemic response, putting its ability to respond to future emergencies in jeopardy, the Government Accountability Office said in a report. The watchdog agency included Department of Health and Human Service on its high-risk list of federal departments and programs susceptible to mismanagement and abuse without significant changes, such as drug and medical product oversight. Three dozen agencies and federal programs are currently on the list. Several years of, quote, leadership shortcomings at HHS undermine many of its efforts to deal with a wide range of public health challenges, including the coronavirus pandemic and extreme weather events, Comptroller General Jean Dodaro said in a statement. The deficiencies include failures to outline roles and responsibilities for other entities involved in a response, difficulties collecting and analyzing data, and problems clearly communicating health messages to the public. The GAO also criticized the department for not working with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, to shore up medical supply chains and said the administration only just began a comprehensive strategy for widespread public COVID testing that it recommended in January of 2021, a year ago. The GAO report comes amid congressional calls to assess the department's pandemic response and establish new guardrails for future emergencies. Senate Health Committee Chair Patty Murray and Ranking Republican Richard Burr proposed legislation last Tuesday that, among other things, would require HHS secretaries to appoint a committee to advise on messaging during public health crises and would require a bipartisan appointed 9/11-style commission to assess the COVID-19 response. The Prevent Pandemics Act would also make the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention director subject to Senate confirmation for the first time and mandate that the agency release four-year strategy reports. Yet HHS problems have festered for years and through other public health crises, including the H1N1 pandemic and Zika virus outbreaks, GAO said. The government watchdog racked up 115 recommendations for the health department since 2007. 72 of those 115 recommendations are still open. The GAO also recommended in a report that the administration bolster nutrition assistance, emergency rental assistance, and tax relief for businesses as part of its COVID-19 response. Okay, well, in an interesting story from the Brookings Institute, there's a long article that gives all their details, but I'll give you the bottom line. Their question is long COVID worsening the labor shortage? Long COVID could account for upwards of 15% of unfilled jobs. So according to their analysis, there are about 1.6 million full-time equivalents of people that have a long COVID who are not able to work. And that is of 10.6 million unfilled jobs. That's where you get the 15%. So this is another reverberation, not just health-wise, but socially and economically. If you're trying to get people back to work, if people have long COVID, that could be 15% of these unfilled jobs are unfilled because people have ongoing health problems directly due to the COVID epidemic. Chronic health problems, a problem. Okay, well, let's take a look at where America is right now with this epidemic. This from an Ipsos poll from January 21st to the 24th. The administration's efforts to distribute masks and tests have been met with widespread public approval. Over 4 in 5 Americans, 84%, support the federal government mailing free at-home COVID tests to anyone who wants one, including a majority, 65%, of the unvaccinated. Similar numbers also support making N95 masks available at pharmacies and health clinics. A large number of Americans, 44%, say they have already ordered a free COVID test through the government or post office, and that was on January 24th, so it looks like probably easily a majority of Americans will be ordering these tests. Many Americans continue to struggle during the Omicron phase of the pandemic. 1 in 5, 21% of Americans say they have gotten a COVID test in the previous week. Among that 21%, a fifth report not being able to get an appointment, 18%, having to wait in a long line, 21%, or trying to buy an at-home test and being unable to find it, 24%. Almost a quarter, 22% of parents report that their children's school or childcare center closed as a result of COVID in the last few weeks. Half of Americans do not expect to return to something like their pre-COVID lives for at least a year, if ever. Fewer than 1 in 5, 18%, say they have already returned to normal. The vaccinated are broadly satisfied with the vaccine, but many are less effusive on its promise to return lives to normal. A large majority, 81%, are satisfied with the vaccine's protection from serious illness or death, including 46% who are very satisfied. A similar level are happy with the vaccine having no notable long-term side effects, 48% very satisfied. The vaccinated are also positive, if less gushing, on the vaccine's protection from catching COVID, with 72% overall satisfied, but only 27% very satisfied. On allowing people to return to pre-pandemic routines, only 18% are very satisfied, 61% overall satisfied, and 30% are not satisfied. This Axios Ipsos poll provides new detail on American COVID-19 mitigation behaviors. 87% of Americans report wearing a mask at least occasionally. Among those, the most popular types of masks are cloth, 39%, or surgical, 35%. Fewer than 1 in 5, or 19%, of mask wearers most frequently wear the most effective respirator-style N95 mask. 18% of Americans say they have tested positive for COVID at some point since the start of the pandemic. Among those, about 2 in 5 tested at an official test location. And a similar number, about 38%, used a PCR test. And about 1 in 8, 15%, used a home antigen test. 36% of Americans say they have tested positive or think they have had COVID since the start of the pandemic. Among those, the majority reported no symptoms, that's 10%, or mild symptoms, 46%. An additional quarter, 28%, report moderate symptoms, while 1 in 8, 14%, report severe symptoms or hospitalization. Okay, well, let's turn to the local COVID-19 update. Well, let's start by saying that the Toledo Lucas County Health Department has ended its testing sites at the rec center in a UAW Local 12, quote, due to decreased testing demand. They had tested an average of about 2,000 people per week for 3 weeks, and this represented about 20% of the total tests reported in Lucas County. Now, the decreased testing demand, I think partly is probably related to the fact that these are the PCR tests, which take several days, sometimes more, to actually get a test result. And I think the workaround, when people start hearing about what the experience that people have had, a lot of people don't really seek this type of testing because it doesn't provide more real-time decision-making capabilities as far as like isolating and such if you have to wait 3 or 4 days from the time you get tested. So we're done with that. Well, on the good news, as far as the average number of daily COVID-19 cases in Lucas County, we had a big drop of the most previous week. We dropped from 802 a day on average to 365. Woohoo! Way to go, Lucas County. Now, the thing is, this is a stunning drop, and we should be congratulated and happy that that happened. But we must also note that while this is the lowest average number of daily cases this month, in January, it's also the highest of any previous month. In other words, the previous, whatever, 22, 23 months of this pandemic, this 365 average per day over the last 7 days is actually the highest. So while it's great for this month, when you look at the pandemic as a whole, we are still in the thick of it. Okay, well, another good news, the testing positivity rates are continuing to decline. They're remaining very high, the testing positivity rates, but they are in the, going down in the right trend. So the testing positivity rates in Lucas County dropped almost 2 points to 20.9%. Ohio dropped like about 4 points or so to 21.9%. And the U.S. dropped over 3 points down to 22.3%. So it looks like we're all hovering around just over 20% or so, which is not good. That still means that our testing system is basically broken. But testing volumes, whether people aren't seeking it or it isn't available, these testing volumes looks like they have peaked and are heading down. Okay, let's turn to long-term care facilities or nursing homes in Lucas County. We did see an increase in the number of active cases, moved up from 124 to 158 cases, and this still is more likely to happen in residents. That represents 97 residents and 61 staff with active COVID cases in the most recent week. The good news, though, is there were no additional deaths reported of long-term care residents. Okay, turning to Lucas County schools, remember last week we had a massive increase. We just crashed through, and remember last week would be from schools from a couple weeks ago, that we had 3 to 4 times the previous record in Lucas County. But we've gone down a little bit. We've dropped down from 221 staff to 203 staff with newly identified infections. And in Lucas County, we dropped from 968 students down to 755 students in the most recent week of reporting. Similarly, in the state, they had record high levels, about double, over double of what the previous high had been. And we dropped slightly from over 4,000 staff to about 3,700 staff infected statewide, and down from over 20,000 students to 18,000 students that were infected in the most previous week of reporting. Okay, the University of Toledo, which does have a vaccine requirement or requiring daily testing, I have no idea how many people are doing that, but they have a pretty high level of vaccination. They have an increase in number of identified COVID cases. They went from 166 to 177, and their surveillance testing is still showing a pretty high amount. It was the same the last couple weeks, at 2.9% of the random testing that they're doing on campus. Okay, well, cases are one thing. Hospitalizations and deaths are a better indicator of what we're really into with this pandemic. And hospitalizations are decreasing in both Lucas County and Ohio. But still, we have to remember that the new hospital admissions are basically at the same level as last winter's peak. So we are still in the thick of it, but the direction is going in the right direction for hospitalizations. Now, deaths are still going up. Deaths nationally are about 2,600 per day on average over the previous week, and you have to expect that this could continue for at least two or three weeks more. I would expect that peak deaths are likely to exceed last winter's peak of 350 deaths per day, although the length of that peak is probably going to be a little bit shorter. So we'll have to see if the total death count ends up being less. But unfortunately, this winter looks strangely and unfortunately, surprisingly, too similar to last winter, when much of the winter was when we had nobody vaccinated. Okay, well, let's turn to vaccinations. Basically, the trend continues where we're getting like 0.4-0.5% of people newly fully vaccinated each week. And the people that are boosted, again, is going up slightly as well. Now, both state, nationally, and locally, we have over a quarter of the entire population that is boosted. And that means that there's almost half of the people that are eligible to be boosted in Ohio are boosted, and almost 42% of people nationally that are eligible to be boosted are boosted. Okay, you are listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. This program is just for the health of it. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's move on to four healthcare stories. First up from Medical Express. Most physicians paid by volume despite push for quality and value. Despite efforts by insurance companies and other payers to move toward compensating physicians based on the quality and value of care they provide, most physicians employed in group practices owned by health systems are paid primarily based on the volume of care they provide, according to a new study by the RAND Corporation. Examining a wide range of medical practices owned by health systems, researchers found that volume-based compensation was the most common type of base pay for more than 80% of primary care physicians and for more than 90% of physician specialists. While financial incentives for quality and cost performance were commonly used by health systems, the percentage of total physician compensation based on quality and cost was modest, 9% for primary care providers and 5% for specialists. The payment systems that are most often in place are designed to maximize health system revenue by incentivizing providers within the system to deliver more services. Yep, be careful. American healthcare has the side effect of the destruction of capital, the destructiveness of capitalism. Okay, and a related story, this from Chief Healthcare Executive. Female doctors spend more time with patients, and it could cost them. Women clinicians are seeing fewer patients and spending more time with them, potentially hurting their income. A new report from Aetna Health, a Massachusetts-based healthcare technology company, showed female clinicians see fewer patients than male doctors in a typical week. Female doctors also spend more time in documenting the records of each patient. Female clinicians schedule an average of 60 encounters with patients per week, while male clinicians schedule an average of 73 patients encountered each week. They both spent the same amount of cumulative time documenting patient records, so women are spending 20% longer on documentation per patient than male clinicians. It's another argument for compensating clinicians based on the quality of their care rather than volume. Doctors are experiencing more stress and burnout in the pandemic, and moving to a value-based care model could help alleviate the pressure on doctors, particularly female clinicians. Women doctors earn $2 million less than male physicians over a 40-year career, according to a study published December 6th in Health Affairs. Among surgical specialists, women typically earn $2.5 million less over their careers, and that female primary care physicians earned about $900,000 less over their careers, the study found. Okay, well, next up from Becker's Hospital Review, patients who are black, unmarried, or on government insurance described more negatively in electronic health record study shows. The language clinicians use in their electronic health record notes varies by patient's race, marital status, and type of insurance, according to a study published in Health Affairs. The research team searched for sentences containing a negative descriptor for patients, such as resistant or noncompliant. The study found black patients were 2.5 times more likely to have one or more negative descriptors in their electronic health record notes than white patients. It also found patients who are unmarried or enrolled in a government insurance program had higher likelihoods over 2 times of negative descriptors than patients who were married or enrolled in private or employer-based insurance plans. The study's authors said their findings raise concerns about racial bias in healthcare and the possible transmission of stigma through the electronic health record. They said providers may need self-awareness and bias training to help change their language. Okay, well, a little bit of good news, this from Medical Express. Racial inequity in follow-up appointment attendance after hospitalization disappears as telemedicine is adopted. Data from 5 Penn Medicine hospitals on post-hospitalization primary care follow-up appointments from 2019 through 2021 was pulled for the study. Overall, post-discharge primary care visit completion rates climbed from 62 to 72% from January to June 2020. They remained significantly high for the rest of the year. But the greatest boost appeared to come from black patients, increasing their visit completion rate from 52 to 70%. For white patients, by contrast, there was little change, from 68% to 67%. Regardless of race, some overall benefits were seen after June 2020. The time between discharge and the first primary care appointment follow-up fell by a day and a half when the appointment was held via telemedicine. Completion rates for the follow-up appointments were 22% higher via telemedicine, and the rate of follow-up within a week of hospitalization was 8% higher as well. While telemedicine came out amid a crisis, incorporating it into regular day-to-day operation appears to have significant value. While there are evolving issues around quality, payment, and regulatory policy, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that telemedicine was and can continue to be a vital access point for many people. If it can promote access and even ameliorate disparities, then it's worth continuing to invest in. I think we're going to see more telehealth, telemedicine, but some of the like emergency declarations and stuff that allowed a change in the rules is ending a lot of places, so it's still going to be a fight. Just one more reason why having an integrated national health program with Health for All would be a good idea.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of Health Care for All has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well now let's move to a couple stories about antibiotic use. I've been covering this off and on for quite a while. This from Medical Express. 1.2 million people died in 2019 from antibiotic-resistant bacterial infections, more deaths than HIV/AIDS or malaria. More than 1.2 million people, and potentially millions more, died in 2019 as a direct result of antibiotic-resistant bacterial infections, according to the most comprehensive estimate to date of the global impact of antimicrobial resistance. The analysis of 204 countries and territories published in The Lancet reveals that antimicrobial resistance is now a leading cause of death worldwide, higher than HIV/AIDS or malaria. It shows that many hundreds of thousands of deaths now occur due to common, previously treatable infections, such as lower respiratory and bloodstream infections, because the bacteria that cause them have become resistant to treatment. The report highlights an urgent need to scale up action to combat this antimicrobial resistance and outlines immediate actions for policymakers that will help save lives and protect health systems. These include optimizing the use of existing antibiotics, taking greater action to monitor and control infections, and providing more funding to develop new antibiotics and treatments. Study co-author Professor Chris Murray of the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington said, "This new data reveal the true scale of antimicrobial resistance worldwide and are a clear signal that we must now act to combat the threat. Previous estimates had predicted 10 million annual deaths from antimicrobial resistance by 2050, but we now know for certain that we are already far closer to that figure than we thought. We need to leverage this data to course correct action and drive innovation if we want to stay ahead in the race against antimicrobial resistance." Estimates of the health impacts of antimicrobial resistance have been published for several countries and regions and for a small number of pathogen drug combinations in a wider range of locations. However, until now, no estimates have covered all locations and a broad range of pathogens and drug combinations. The analysis shows that antimicrobial resistance was directly responsible for an estimated 1.27 million deaths worldwide and associated with an estimated 5 million deaths in 2019. HIV/AIDS and malaria have been estimated to cause 860,000 deaths and 640,000 deaths respectively for 2019. Drug resistance in lower respiratory infections, such as pneumonia, had the greatest impact on disease burden, causing more than 400,000 deaths and associated with more than 1.5 million deaths. Drug resistance in bloodstream infections, which can lead to the life-threatening condition called sepsis, caused around 370,000 deaths and was associated with nearly 1.5 million deaths. Drug resistance in intra-abdominal infections, commonly caused by appendicitis, led directly to around 210,000 deaths and was associated with around 800,000 deaths. While antimicrobial resistance poses a threat to people of all ages, young people were found to be particularly high risk, with around 1 in 5 deaths attributable occurring to children aged under 5 years. Writing in a linked comment, Dr. Ramnam Laxminarayan of the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy, who was not involved in the study, said, "From being an unrecognized and hidden problem, a clearer picture of the burden of antimicrobial resistance is finally emerging. Even the lower end of 911,000 deaths estimated by Murray and colleagues is higher than the number of deaths from HIV, which attracts close to $50 billion each year. However, global spending on addressing antimicrobial resistance is probably much lower than that. This needs to change. Spending needs to be directed to preventing infections in the first place, making sure existing antibiotics are used appropriately and judiciously, and to bringing new antibiotics to market. Health and political leaders at local, national, and international levels need to take seriously the importance of addressing antimicrobial resistance and the challenge of poor access to affordable, effective antibiotics." And I'll just note, as I've previously reported, that this antimicrobial resistance is being driven heavily by livestock use, mostly in beef and pork production. So the larger parts of our society impact medicine in a very huge way. Okay, well, another direct way that antibiotics use impacts our health is in this story from Medical Express. Scientists find link between antibiotics and colon cancer. The researchers found for the first time that while the overall numbers remain relatively low, antibiotic use was linked with an estimated 50% higher risk of colon cancer in people aged under 50 and an estimated 9% higher risk in those 50 and over. Reasons behind this link are purported to be due to the impact of antibiotics on the natural diversity of bacteria within the gut microbiome, which can potentially lead to altered bacterial activity and interfere with normal immune function. This can lead to chronic inflammation and might increase the risk of cancer. Against a background of rising antibiotic resistance, these data come as a timely reminder to primary care physicians and their patients that taking antibiotics can have consequences, some of which may be yet to emerge. Their use should be reserved for clinical situations where they are truly necessary. And that goes triply for animals, where they're used widespread just to get them to grow faster and to be able to use super concentrated growing techniques where they're all crammed in together, more susceptible to disease. Yikes. Okay, next up, a story on the environment from Science Daily. Rural air pollution may be as hazardous as urban, study finds. A new study of air quality in the Midwestern U.S. found that measuring the mass concentration of PM2.5, that is particles that are 2.5 micrometers in diameter or smaller, does not correspond well with current methods for classifying particle toxicity, the actual toxicity. Additionally, the researchers found that PM2.5 exposure may be just as hazardous in rural areas as in urban areas, evidence that challenges a common misconception that air pollution is more toxic in urban areas than in these rural areas, researchers said. Not all particles that make up the PM2.5 contribute to health equally. Most air pollution studies have shifted focus from particle mass to a property called cellular oxidative potential. Cellular oxidative potential describes a capability of the particles to generate reactive oxygen-based chemicals that can lead to a variety of health problems in the cells of lung tissue. The research team found that all locations shared similar levels of oxidative potential, that is the potential for health problems, but saw a poor correlation between oxidative potential and mass, the traditional PM2.5 measure. That suggests that some of the lighter particles that make up PM2.5 contribute more to tissue damage than others, the study reports. Additionally, the oxidative potential of the rural samples was higher in the summer than in the winter, suggesting that summertime agricultural activity can produce these particles that are just as toxic as those from urban settings. The current methods using to measure PM2.5 oxidative potential for health problems are time-consuming and laborious, but we hope that our new methodology, combined with these study findings, makes testing for oxidative potential more appealing to environmental regulators and policymakers. Okay, moving forward, science. Way to go. Okay, well, another environmental story. This from My Nation of Birth from Medical Express. Blood lead levels in Haiti, a warning for other countries. Blood lead levels among the population of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, are on average 5 times higher than in the United States, says researchers, highlighting the urgent need to address the problem in developing countries more broadly. In high-income countries, lead exposure is associated with cardiovascular disease and higher blood pressure, but the link has not been adequately evaluated in low- and middle-income countries, say the authors of a study published in the journal Hypertension. In a cohort study involving over 2,500 adults, U.S. and Haitian researchers found that 4 out of 10 people had levels of the metal in their blood considered very high, while 7 out of 10 had detectable levels. They say the results serve as a red flag for other developing countries whose populations may be exposed to lead contamination and are therefore more prone to cardiovascular diseases. According to UNICEF, lead is a highly poisonous element that is responsible for nearly 1.5% of total annual global deaths, almost as many as from HIV and AIDS, and more than from malaria. Lead poisoning affects nearly 1/3 of the world's children. The scientists behind the Haiti study say they now want to continue their research by analyzing possible sources of lead exposure on the island nation. These are suspected to include gasoline, pans and cookware enameled with lead-containing compounds, and car batteries that have been improperly disposed of. Richard Fuller, the CEO of Pure Earth, a nonprofit organization focused on fighting disease-causing pollution, believes the Haiti study results are in line with blood lead levels seen in most countries around the world. Fuller explains that sources of lead exposure can vary from country to country. In developed countries, the main sources used to be leaded gasoline, but it has been phased out in recent decades, he says. In low- and middle-income countries, one of the main sources of lead exposure is car batteries recycling, which is the most common use of lead today. Lead is also added to spices to make them more colorful. Oh my goodness. This problem is much more serious than people realize and deserves international attention. Well, there you go. Okay, well, I wanted to end the show with an article that, while it points out a problem, it could actually be an opportunity to solve another problem. This from Stat News. Eliminating the FDA's blood donation ban on men who have sex with men would help ease the U.S. blood shortage. For the first time ever, the American Red Cross this month declared a national blood shortage crisis, and hospitals are pulling out calls for donors. Yet the Food and Drug Administration continues to ban men who have sex with men from donating blood. It is long past time for the FDA to eliminate this ban. No other group is similarly banned from donating blood. Prohibiting only men who have sex with men from donating blood is the definition of homophobic, because it presumes that this sexual orientation is unsafe. This is provably false. Studies report no risk to the blood supply in other countries that do not ban donations from this group of men. The assumption that blood from sexually active gay and bisexual men is deadly is deadly. UCLA researchers say lifting the ban would mean as many as 350,000 new donors, and that could treat more than 1 million people. The FDA's current policy is this: a man who has had sex with another man in the last 3 months may not donate blood. It is an outdated artifact of the early years of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Yet here we are today. To turn away blood donors because of their sexual orientation, while there's a critical blood shortage during the worst pandemic in a century, is medically useless, is medically baseless, and morally reprehensible. A more sensible approach would be to assess potential blood donors' risk for infectious disease on a case-by-case basis, regardless of sexual orientation. Other countries are doing just that. 3 weeks ago, the Canadian Blood Services announced it would entirely lift its ban on men who have sex with men donating blood. Israel did the same thing back in August. Both are shifting toward a practice similar to Italy's, which eliminated its ban in 2001. That country went straight from an outright ban to an individual risk assessment, a practice that does not consider sexual orientation, but at-risk behavior. A study led by Italy's National Institute of Health compared HIV infection among blood donors before and after the ban was lifted. There was no difference in the rate between men who have sex with men and heterosexuals. The ban on blood donations by men who have sex with men should have been ended in the wake of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando in 2016, when men who tried to give their blood to save their friend's life could not do so. Now, as countries around the world report dangerously low numbers of blood donors, and the American Red Cross says hospitals in the U.S. have less than a day's supply of certain blood types, the FDA ought to do what is medically and morally right and end the ban on blood donation by sexually active men who have sex with men. And let this also serve as a reminder. If you're a regular blood donor or haven't donated in a while, go donate blood. If you've never donated blood and you're eligible, now would be a good time to do that. Okay, well, I've got a dozen bonus articles that you can read online. I'll give you the link at the end, and you can read these dozen articles or any of the articles that I've referenced in this episode. So up first, one, patchwork system for rationing a COVID drug sends immunocompromised patients on a Hunger Games hunt. Two, PCR COVID tests are not very useful. Focus on rapid antigen tests instead. Three, here's how to get free N95 masks from pharmacies or community health centers. Hopefully some practical info there. Four, some Americans are hesitant about COVID vaccines, but they're all in on unproven treatments. Yep, a story from Ron DeSantis' Florida. And five, what we can learn from how the 1918 pandemic ended. Pandemic fatigue and a desperation to return to, quote, normal kills more in the end. Six, why the chemical industry is an overlooked climate foe and what to do about it. 7. Biden's focus on environmental justice led to a year of progress and burnout as the top environmental justice official resigns. Another good example of a more holistic approach is that while environmental justice is a wonderful thing, if we're going to burn out the people who are working for such wonderful things, we have a new problem. Of course, that's a problem in a lot of work settings. Number 8, giving low-income families cash can help babies' brain activity. No strings attached subsidies for low-income families improve brain activity in infants, a novel clinical trial finds. We've known for a long time that poverty affects babies' brain development, but this is really good science that proves what was believed to be true. 9, major review finds limited effectiveness for medication and therapy. Most mental health treatments are only marginally better than placebo. So, mental health drugs, not a big ring of endorsement there for them. And sort of in contrast to that, the Article 10 is rising social and existential uncertainty linked to mental distress. So on one end, you've got the medical approach, and the other end, you've got kind of the social determinants of health, and in this case, as far as mental health. 11, how to build resilience and boost your mental health. A nice little summary of things that you can do, very practical information. And last but not least, number 12, a very interesting read. Learn some history about an important issue of sleep. Can medieval sleeping habits fix America's insomnia? The history of first sleep and second sleep holds surprising lessons about pre-industrial life, 21st century anxiety, and the problem with digging for utopia in the past. So you can read these and other stories if you go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, Passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.